Chapter 4, Force Structure and Modernization. Jackson oversaw the restructuring and modernization of the Navy during his presidency. His predecessor, John Quincy Adams, had surged ship construction and employed squadrons worldwide. Rather than steer a different course, Jackson continued to expand the Navy and its squadrons. To do so, he first invested in the maintenance and repair of existing warships. He then continued the Adams-initiated construction of the first dry docks and other infrastructure. Jackson then authorized the construction and purchase of sloops and schooners, which enabled him to continue high employment rates. Despite the utility of these ships, he permitted construction for prestige purposes of the second-largest ship of the line in the world. Finally, the Jackson administration endorsed the advancement of steam technology for warships to modernize the Navy. Several of Jackson's predecessors, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, James Monroe, and John Quincy Adams, had served as ambassadors to European courts. Consequently, they had at least some first-hand understanding of merchant and Navy ships. More than 3,500 nautical miles of ocean separated the United States from Great Britain. These individuals had stood on the decks of warships. They had seen American sailors who climbed the rigging and who ate food for sustenance rather than taste. They spoke to the officers who commanded the men. When they arrived in European ports, they saw before them the might of maritime powers and the navies built to defend merchant fleets and deploy forces. It is not surprising, therefore, that the establishment, construction, and use of a navy for the United States would be significant during their presidential administrations. Unlike those predecessors, although he was familiar with the Navy through the Battle of New Orleans, Jackson had no such similar grand experience since he never visited a European port. This is not to say he did not understand the Navy, but his experiences were different from his predecessors as they were far more parochial. Nevertheless, he may have been shaped by his exposure to navies beginning with his youth. The first may have originated with the British siege of Charleston, South Carolina in 1780. When the British Navy surrounded American land and naval forces, while American ships made their way upriver to prevent their capture. The British force included 3 ships of the line, 4 frigates, sloops and galleys, and approximately 90 transports. He was only 13 when his relatives asked Jackson's mother to permit him, not to fight, just to help out in operations against British forces. In the subsequent Battle of Hanging Rock, an elder Jackson declared himself unable to give an account of the battle. Not only had he not participated in the fighting, he had not even seen it. The subsequent capitulation of the American force at Charleston would be the largest of the Revolution and the third greatest in American history. American soldiers were held on prison ships in the harbor. In 1781, Elizabeth Jackson succumbed to the same cholera outbreak that affected those in her care. She left her son an orphan. At his young age, Jackson would not likely have distinguished between the classes of ships present in Charleston Harbor. Instead, the Royal Navy represented an unstoppable force. It prevented American ships from escaping through an effective blockade, and it brought supplies and soldiers ashore that had a direct effect on his family. A second exposure took place in the waning days of the War of 1812, as General Jackson again fought the British. Jackson awaited British Admiral Alexander Cochrane, who had failed to take Fort McHenry and Baltimore, Maryland. Cochrane was unable to convey his deep-draft ships through the shallow waters of Lake Bourne, defended by Lieutenant Thomas Catby Jones's 5 Jefferson-era gunboats. Cochrane deployed 42 longboats with carronades, which eventually overwhelmed Jones's force. Lake Bourne was a tactical victory for the British, but a strategic loss. Jones's action provided Jackson time to assemble his own forces and prepare defenses against General Sir Edward Pakenham's army of 14,000 men. Lake Bourne and New Orleans represented to Jackson the value of the Army and Navy working jointly in combat operations, a view that would reemerge during the Jackson-initiated Second Seminole War. The third influence on Jackson's maritime view may have been his journey to his inauguration. Most of his trip from Tennessee to Washington was on America's extensive river system aboard steamships. This trip reinforced upon Jackson the vital role riverine and other waterborne commerce already played in the country's economy. International commerce was vulnerable to pirates, and competing navies also threatened the lifeblood of America's economy. Consequently, a standing navy during peacetime was a necessity. In addition, he observed, not for the first time, the value of the nascent technology of steam power for ships. Jackson would have recognized that they were thus far insufficient for transoceanic travel, but in the near term could be useful for coastal or harbor defense. The Evolving Navalist. One historian's precedent-setting work defined the navalist and anti-navalist. A major distinguishing factor between the two philosophies was the number of ships authorized or constructed. However, the authorization and construction of Navy ships were irregular during the early Republic, from the founding of the Navy under President John Adams through the end of Jackson's presidency. An analysis of the shipbuilding program during that period reveals that presidential administrations, regardless of party, were mostly navalist, especially John Adams and John Quincy Adams. A closer assessment suggests that Jackson should be included among the navalists. The U.S. Navy built a total of 86 warships from 1798 to 1837. Most shipbuilding occurred during armed conflicts. During this 40-year period, there were four spikes in ship construction that reached their apex with a 10-ship build. The first spike was the result of the Naval Act of 1794 and the creation of the Department of the Navy under John Adams. The bill was passed under threat of Algerine piracy and authorized the construction of the first six frigates designed by Joshua Humphreys, but it prepared the country for a maritime conflict with France. The second spike occurred during the Second War with the British. The small U.S. Navy was still reliant, given the immediacy of military operations, upon privateers under the construction of more ships. Due to a lack of resources and the length of construction, the Navy would commission ships of the line only after the war's completion. Congress thus passed an act for the gradual increase of the Navy in 1816. The legislation authorized the construction of 9 74-gun ships of the line and 12 44-gun frigates. Under the Constitution, funding requires authorization and appropriation. Authorizing legislation provides policy guidance and determines that Congress may fund a program. Nevertheless, Congress may authorize a program, but it remains unfunded if a separate committee refuses to appropriate the funds in a designated fiscal year. Congress did not fully fund the authorizing legislation, instead only providing sufficient funds to purchase materials and store them in shipyards for most of the ships, while fully funding a few ships of the line and frigates. Enough, however, were commissioned by 1821 to result in the third spike. The fourth spike came under the presidential term of John Quincy Adams. Adams commissioned 13 warships, no small feat given that he was only in office for 4 years, whereas his three immediate predecessors had each served for 8 years. Adams' construction program, thus, is the largest peacetime increase of warships during this period. A lull followed each construction spike. This is not unusual in the United States or for other nations in post-war environments. Military budgets increased exponentially during the war, and when the war is over, those expenses are no longer required during peacetime. After the Quasi-War and the First Barbary War, Jefferson in 1805, for example, decommissioned several larger ships to reduce government expenditures. Again, the Navy represented a sizable portion, from 20% to 30% of the federal budget, so any decrease in the Navy meant a president could be more fiscally responsible in peacetime. Only the navalists supported an expansion of the Navy in peacetime. Consequently, Monroe's administration advocated an increase to establish more distant squadrons to protect American commerce. This squadron system also enabled a faster response time to overseas threats. The number of ships built also sheds light on the views of the presidents, as well as the country's priorities. Of the 91 ocean-going warships in the Navy from 1798 to 1837, American shipyards built 51 during periods of wartime operations and 40 during peacetime. That 44% of America's warship construction occurred during peacetime is remarkable. This suggests not only a necessity for peacetime ships, but a commitment to build and maintain them. America was, therefore, largely a maritime-oriented nation, willing to spend the money to defend its commerce. The depredations committed on U.S. shipping by the Barbary states in the 1780s and 1790s and threats from greater powers were not lost on the American public. Washington paid tribute to the Barbary states out of the federal budget. The average American, however, was uninformed about government policies and budgets. Normally, they might have ignored it. In this case, the American public was very aware of the reality, given that the local level directly felt the ransoms paid for seized crews. Jackson's administration confirms that he was a navalist, based on three quantifiable criteria of ship production. The first data point is the average number of ships built annually. From 1798 to 1837, an average of 2.3 ships were built annually. During war years, the annual number of ships built was 4.6, and during the peacetime years, the number was 1.4. Jackson built 2.1 ships per year, significantly higher than the overall comparable peacetime average. If one removes Jackson's 8 years, the average of the remaining peacetime years' average is 1.2 ships built per year, thus widening the construction gap compared to Jackson's 2.1. The second way of viewing the data is by the total number of ships built by administration. Remarkably, John Adams built 29 ships during the creation of the Department of the Navy, a period that also coincided with the quasi-war with France. Adding to this impressive achievement was that he served for only 4 years, and only lasted 3 years are included in this study. Madison, who had 3 years of war during his 8-year administration, built 17 ships, the same as Jackson. Behind them was John Quincy Adams, whose 4 years produced 13 ships with the other presidents, Jefferson and Monroe, in single digits. The third set of data is the average number built annually by each of the period administrations. Again, Adams led them all with 9.7 built on average per year. Distantly behind him was his son, John Quincy Adams, 3.3. Madison and Jackson each built, on average, 2.1 ships annually. Seen from each perspective, the data demonstrates that Jackson had a deep commitment to the Navy and its mission that was equal to the navalists and exceeded that of the anti-navalist presidents. Setting priorities, maintenance, and repair. When Jackson became president, he did not immediately embark on a shipbuilding program. Instead, he wisely chose to invest in the maintenance and repair of the existing, aging fleet. For example, 4 of the Navy's original 6 frigates, Constitution, Constellation, Congress, and United States, were still considered operational, at least fundamentally, after 30 years and 3 wars. Of the fleet's 10 operational frigates, only 3 were less than a decade old when Jackson assumed office. In 1822, the average ship age was 9.4 years. When Jackson became president in 1829, the average was 11.6 years. In the final year of his administration, it was 17.7 years. Moreover, after the War of 1812, the Navy was maintaining distant stations for longer periods of time. It was not unusual for ships to deploy for 2 to 3 years on patrol. In one case, the ship of the line, USS Franklin, deployed as the flagship of the Mediterranean Squadron from 1817 to 1820. It returned to the United States for a refit only long enough to prepare it for another three-year deployment from 1821 to 1824 as the flagship of the Pacific Squadron. Jackson arrived in Washington intent on bringing fiscal responsibility to the U.S. government. In Branch's first annual report to Congress, he articulated the administration's position that ship construction would discontinue except for in the case of an immediate emergency. In 1829, the total Navy budget was $3 million, approximately 20% of the entire federal budget. Of that $3 million, $430,000 was directed for repairs of ships in ordinary and wear and tear for ships in commission, hereafter maintenance and repair. The following year, maintenance and repair increased to $590,000 as the Navy budget rose to $3.5 million. Jackson's austerity measures and resolution of financial discrepancies by Fourth Auditor Amos Kendall allowed the President to reduce the Navy budget to $2.6 million. Remarkably, maintenance and repair funding increased to $615,000. By the final year of his administration in 1837, the maintenance and repair budget increased to $1.2 million. Why is this important? Jackson was in fact enabling the Navy to provide a far larger force if called upon. This would be accomplished by building new ships while ensuring aging ships or ships that remained in ordinary, those authorized but not fully funded vessels that lay in various states and shipyards on the eastern seaboard, received adequate attention. When Jackson assumed the presidency, he had at his disposal nearly three dozen commissioned ships. Many were deployed. Each year, the Secretary of the Navy, based on assessments from the chief naval constructor, reported to Congress on the state of commissioned ships. The assessment also included ships in ordinary. Some ships had their keel laid, while others had partially constructed hulls. Some materials remained the victims of weather, as they were stored in the open air given the limited availability of storage sheds. The most expensive ships in terms of cost and manpower were the 74 gunships of the line. Of the six Delaware-class ships of the line, all had been laid down. Due to excessive costs, two were commissioned in the 1820s, two were only commissioned in the 1860s during the Civil War, and two were never launched or commissioned. Construction was not the only significant cost. So, too, was the price of operating the ship in distant waters. In 1829, for example, the USS Delaware in the Mediterranean required more than 300 barrels of flour, nearly 3,000 barrels of bread, 1,200 barrels of beef and pork, more than 2,000 gallons of vinegar, 1,000 gallons of molasses, and more than 24,000 gallons of whiskey for a three-month period. In the 1829 report, Secretary Branch assessed the Alabama could be ready in 3 months, if needed. Navy constructors assessed her hull to be in good order. In Boston, the ships of the line Virginia and Vermont were both 4 months from completion. Columbus could be ready in 75 days, while the Independence required entirely new decks, planking, and coppering. In Gosport, near Norfolk, the ship of the line New York could be launched in 3 months. But the North Carolina had had all her oakum removed and had no estimated time for completion. At the New York Navy Yard, the commissioned and operational ships of the line Franklin, Ohio, and Washington all needed extensive repairs. The coppering of the Ohio alone required 6 months. Far different was the ship of the line at the Philadelphia Navy Yard. She was the 120-gun ship Pennsylvania, also authorized in 1816. For more than a decade, she was in pieces, awaiting funding for construction and preparation for sea. In the 1829 and 1830 annual reports, she was assessed to be ready in 6 months. She would have to wait until later in Jackson's administration for determination as to her fate. The entire class, however, failed to evolve under constructor Samuel Humphreys. The situation with the state of American frigates was different from the large ships of the line. All 8 Potomac-class frigates, authorized in 1816, were eventually commissioned, although only one was commissioned prior to Jackson's presidency, and one in 1831. Across the shipyards, the Santee, Cumberland, Constitution, Raritan, Sabine, Savannah, Potomac, St. Lawrence, and Constellation were all in various states of construction or repair. Assessments differ on the quality of shipbuilding, maintenance, and approaches in the Jacksonian era. One example was the frigate USS Macedonian in Gosport Naval Shipyard in 1829. One historian had argued that the Macedonian had been unserviceable for years, but she remained under registers to obtain annual maintenance funds from the Navy. According to the February 1829 assessment, the ship was in a state of decay, especially the white oak, the timber used specifically for Navy ships since the Humphreys frigates. Chappell, however, did not consider that the Macedonian had only recently returned from deployment in 1828, or that the U.S. Constellation and USS John Adams had already been planned for refurbishment. Funds were available, but the docks at which the work would be performed were not available. In an unpublished manuscript, another academic researcher challenged the earlier work. Secretary of the Navy, John Branch, apparently opposed work on the ship to streamline the Navy itself. Reducing the number of ships meant a reduction in annual maintenance costs. Nevertheless, Secretary Woodbury added a request for more than $200,000 to rebuild, repair, and equip the Macedonian in 1831. The key term in that direction was rebuild. Branch's interpretation was that rebuilding meant simply new construction, which required a supplementary budget request to Congress. A few years later, the Macedonian's keel would find use in the construction of a new ship with the same name. This confusion over rebuilding was not isolated to this event. 2 decades later, for example, the USS Constellation had most of the planks and ribs replaced and retained only the keel. The ship consequently had a far different design, particularly with her new rounded stern indicative of mid-19th century British-inspired alterations, rather than early 19th century standards. Historians have also failed to adequately consider the impact of patriotism behind the support of shipbuilding. In 1832, Woodbury asked for funds for more live oak to rebuild the 22-gun USS Scion and for additional funds for the frigate USS Java. Constitution had taken the British-built Scion and Java as war prizes during the War of 1812. Macedonian was also a Royal Navy ship captured in 1812 by United States under command of Stephen Decatur. Constellation, though better known for her services during the Quasi-War, had also fought in the War of 1812. Thus, despite their various states of disrepair, their names alone conjured up patriotic sentiment. Proponents of the funds appealed to the patriotism of other congressional members. The War of 1812 represented the most recent conflict during which American frigates largely bested Royal Navy ships in single-ship actions. Support for older ships continued through Jackson's administration. In 1834, for example, Congress approved another special appropriation of nearly $200,000 to rebuild Congress, another Humphreys frigate. Despite this initial support, the ship proved too unstable and was broken up that year. Early in the administration, Branch recommended to Congress that it should take a twofold approach. First, consolidate the ships that could be completed, and second, delay the construction of new ships. Branch used one ship in particular to make his case for delaying construction so that he could focus on maintenance. The 44-gun frigate USS Hudson was the only ship in her class. Originally named the Liberator, she had been constructed in 1826 for the Greek government for Greece's War of Independence. When that government failed to pay for the ship, the Navy retained and renamed her. She was fitted out in 1828 for a cruise to Brazilian Station. The estimate for fitting her out was $51,770. This included $15,000 for labor and materials, $18,000 for the boatsman's department, $15,000 for deficiencies in cables, anchors, hawsers, and other equipment, $12,400 for the gunner's department, $5,400 for the sailmaker's department, and $1,900 for the cooper's department. On the ship's first cruise, Captain Stephen Cassin reported the ship constantly required repairs of some kind. "I regret to state," he wrote to Branch, "that the ship throughout is in a very rapid state of decay, and in my opinion, cannot be kept out longer than May or June next with safety. In addition, although food was rarely optimal on Navy ships, Cassin also reported that he would not be asking for the staples such as molasses, rice, cheese, and beans. From experience," he added, "it has been found that some of these articles are of so perishable a nature that heretofore most instances unfit to be served." The Hudson was a troubled ship structurally. Ships with significant structural and maintenance problems also manifest their problems in the morale of their crews, an occurrence as familiar to the 21st century Navy as it was 200 years ago. Therefore, it is important to assess shipboard life during its cruise. One method of assessing morale is through courts-martial. This is both an effective quantitative and qualitative means. The reasons for the courts-martial and the text of the records illustrate the qualitative element. One can establish with the quantitative element comparative number of courts-martial throughout the fleet. Courts-martial abounded aboard USS Hudson. Rank did not protect anyone, and behavior was not indicative of rank. Sailors and officers alike found themselves pulled into this vortex of personal irresponsibility, professional negligence, and internecine irresponsibility. Sometimes these courts-martial were about Jackson himself. For example, Sailing Master Lieutenant Thomas Hammersley was charged in a case of political disagreement with a British officer in Rio de Janeiro, and using disrespectful language about his own commodore, John Creighton. Hammersley appealed to the Secretary of the Navy, arguing that the root cause was due to his political sentiments, namely that the junior officer supported Jackson in the election. When challenged by the slanderous British officer, Hammersley had simply attempted to vindicate Jackson, whose reputation he considered a national property. In his defense, Branch wrote to Jackson that there was no improper trial and that the argument with the British officer did not stem from improper motives, but was rather prompted by feelings of national pride. Jackson approved Branch's recommendation to retain the lieutenant. Given the number of courts-martial for such a small ship, it is difficult to trace the extent of charges by crew members against other ships' personnel. Surgeon Andrew Cook charged Marine Second Lieutenant Francis Neville for conducting unbecoming an officer, gross falsehoods, and scandalous conduct, specifically for calling Commodore John Creighton a damned scoundrel and a villain. Neville was found guilty and dismissed from the squadron. Midshipman William Moore placed similar charges against Midshipman Ferdinand Smith for striking another midshipman. Found guilty, he was sentenced to be cashiered. Only three individuals could approve, modify, or nullify a court-martial: the Commodore of the squadron, the Secretary of the Navy, or the President of the United States. Creighton deemed it a harsh sentence. Jackson eventually concurred and ordered the midshipman returned to duty. Lieutenant Tom Freeland was charged with disrespect towards Commodore Creighton and sentenced to dismissal from the squadron. Again, Jackson interceded, questioning the validity of the court as it served as both accuser and witnesses, and Freeland was ordered back to duty. Lieutenant Joshua Sands was tried for neglecting to enforce regulation of the ship and using menacing words against the surgeon. Surgeon Henry Bassett was charged with falsehoods and conduct unbecoming an officer. The results of each court-martial quickly spread as junior officers in particular wrote to one another. Such was the case of Surgeon John Wiley, writing to Lieutenant Samuel DuPont. "You have heard doubtless of the quarrels and court-martials on board the Hudson, but you will be surprised to learn that Captain Creighton's particular supporter and judge-advocate on all the trials has himself been dismissed from the Navy by the President for personal abuse of the chief magistrate." Unusually troubled ships did not escape the attention of officers. Surgeon John Wiley wrote of the quarrels and courts-martial aboard the Hudson. Wiley likely referred to at least two trials, both held in the harbor of Rio de Janeiro. The first was the aforementioned trial of Marine Second Lieutenant Francis Neville. The second was the trial of midshipman William Moore for provoking and reproachful language for calling another midshipman a liar and a son of a bitch. Moore was sentenced to be cashiered. Although Jackson reduced the sentence, Moore resigned in 1832. Wiley was correct to be concerned about the Hudson. While on Brazil Station, no fewer than 7 courts-martial were held involving its officers. Another 8 courts-martial involving its officers and crew were held when the ship returned to New York. One cannot discount that the ship suffered from a lack of leadership. One historian suggests that Creighton had the reputation of being the greatest martinet in the Navy, but one who held the importance of appearances and drilling. While commander of the ship of the line Washington in the Mediterranean, Creighton struck midshipman John Marston. Marston brought charges against Creighton, which were dismissed as malicious, frivolous, and vexatious. After a similar incident with Commodore Oliver Hazard Perry striking a midshipman, 51 midshipmen wrote to Congress asking it to investigate. Navy captains responded by demanding the readjustment of the midshipmen. The Senate Naval Affairs Committee largely ignored the issue, instead suggesting that the Navy handle its own affairs of justice. In the decade from 1828 to 1839, the Navy held 309 courts-martial. Nearly 20 of those were on the Hudson alone, which was the second highest number of any ship in service during that period. The only other ship with more courts-martial was the USS Java, with more than 25. In 1832, Secretary of the Navy Levi Woodbury asked Congress for additional funds for the Java, a request made specifically because of its own significant problems. The Java had been built in haste as a 44-gun frigate during the War of 1812. When it returned from a cruise in 1831, it was made into a receiving ship in Norfolk and was unable to be put to sea again. Built of inferior materials, the ship was assessed as defective in all respects. Another source on officers also communicated about the state of the ships and their captains. Mackay lamented the fact that the Hornet's government of the ship was weak and imbecile to a degree of which you can form no conception. The Premier is totally incompetent and disqualified in every point of view. Of the USS Warren in 1836, one officer wrote that it had gone to sea without a proper overhaul. The spar deck leaked, parts of the ship were rotted, and the trucks of the guns were untrustworthy. While it could be argued that every sailor before or since has complained about their ship in some way, the high deployment rate of sloops immediately before and during Jackson's presidency meant significant maintenance issues that were reflected in the observations of the junior officers. By 1836, the only two ships deemed unfit for service by the Board of Navy Commissioners were the Hudson and the Java. Two key assessments can be derived by this fact. First, there was a casual relationship between significant maintenance and repair issues with crew morale. Second, Jackson's early emphasis on maintenance and repair investments, especially in the first 3 years of his administration, yielded positive results in the fleet. Had he not done so, it is likely that additional ships would have been deemed unfit for service by the end of his second term. Instead, Jackson left office with a Navy better prepared to conduct peacetime and potential wartime operations. Maintenance and repair of ships were only some factors in ensuring the fleet was ready for long-term deployments or at domestic bases awaiting orders. The Navy required better facilities. Dry docks and Navy yards. To better prepare the Navy for long-term operations, Jackson supported the continued construction of the first dry docks and increasing the efficiency of the Navy yards. This enabled quicker and cheaper services of the ships. Based on input from the Board of Navy Commissioners in 1829, Branch found that the Navy was cutting the best timber in the country for authorized ships that were not being constructed, and thus the timber was being exposed to the elements. According to the Board, the resulting decomposition was ruinously wasteful. Branch conceded that Jackson's intervention was required. The administration had to decide. Most of the Navy yards were nearly three decades old. Portsmouth, in New Hampshire, was built in 1800. Boston and New York were established in 1801. Norfolk had only recently been established in 1827, with a new dry dock in the early phases of construction. The Washington Navy Yard was the oldest shore establishment, built in 1799 and commanded by Commodore Thomas Tingey, from its opening until a month before Jackson's inauguration. Even the shipyards were not immune from political machinations and debates. In 1829, there was at least one incident reported to Branch from the Philadelphia Navy Yard, leveling charges against a senior civilian worker regarding improper influence at the last election and of abusing General Jackson and his deceased lady. In 1834, Charlestown Navy Yard in Massachusetts became the scene of one of the most tangible outrages. Captain Jesse Duncan Elliott was one of the Navy's Jackson men. He was appointed commandant of the Charlestown Navy Yard in 1833. In his own words, he revered Jackson, and in 1834, to honor him, had a figurehead of the president made for and mounted on the bow of the USS Constitution. Doing so in the Adams family backyard was tantamount to treason in the eyes of his detractors, who threatened to tar and feather him. The ship was nestled between the ships of the line USS Columbia and USS Independence. Bostonian Samuel Worthington Dewey took it upon himself and rowed to the Constitution's bow during a thunderstorm and sawed off the head. Elliot wrote of it that a hireling from the darkling brook of party ruffians stirs with a dagger the ashes of a hero's grave. Elliot claimed further desecration of the figurehead. The head of the image was brought in, laid upon the table, and bacchanalian orgies were held over it. In Branch's first year as secretary, he pursued cost-saving measures with the Navy Yards, recognizing their existence as one of the costliest functions in the Navy. He again turned to the Board of Navy Commissioners to investigate, asking if the budget could be materially diminished by a reduction of their number. The Board took a strategic approach to the study based on the geographic threats and technologies. Based on geographical positioning and historical experiences from the Revolution and War of 1812, Chesapeake Bay and Narragansett Bay, off Rhode Island, were the most vulnerable to foreign incursion in what its members called our maritime frontier. The Board envisioned a spirited defense of those frontiers with both ships of the line and steam batteries. It deemed Portsmouth as the least defensible. New York, Philadelphia, and Pensacola were assessed as not accessible enough. Washington had larger ships, but they could be moved by steamboats. The Board's report recommended retaining the Navy Yards at Boston, Washington, and Norfolk, as well as creating another near the Gulf of Mexico, an oddly ambiguous locale in the later case, since only Pensacola had some provisions for the Navy. Despite its small size, Pensacola was vitally important to the Navy, since it was best positioned to protect the Navy's strategic asset, the wide swath of live oak trees that had given the Navy a significant advantage over its earlier French and British opponents. Live oak, the Board noted, was the object of pillage by unprincipled nations. It was one of the densest woods in the world, and its incorporation into the USS Constitution's hull, for example, led to its moniker, Old Ironsides, when British cannonballs simply bounced off. Regarding Live Oak, the majority of funds spent between 1827 and 1830 were on the purchase of the Live Oak cut to molds. Other costs included purchasing land, agents' salaries, and examinations and surveys. In addition, the board could justify a Navy Yard in the Gulf of Mexico for economic security. Colonial and early Republic-era U.S. trade depended heavily on maritime routes to the West Indies. This was one reason why Jackson expanded that squadron. By 1829, the Mississippi River system accounted for half of all U.S. exports. As Jackson learned during the Battle of New Orleans and the journey to his inauguration, the river system had become the lifeblood of the economy and ought to be viewed from a strategic standpoint. This viewpoint was not unique to Jackson and the Democrats. One of its strongest supporters in the Senate was Samuel Southard. The former Secretary of the Navy under the second Adams now served on the Committee on Naval Affairs. Like his colleagues, he supported deepening Pensacola Bay, constructing a dry dock there, and building a marine railway for the repair of warships. As was and is standard in military funding discussions by presidents or members of Congress, local politicians and interests advocated for their communities. Jackson's presidency was no different. For example, in 1836, the mayor and city council of Baltimore appealed to the president to establish a Navy Yard there. Similarly, 2 years earlier, community business and political leaders in Charleston advocated a naval depot and dry dock in that key South Carolina city. Senator William J. Grayson, also serving on the Committee on Naval Affairs, argued on behalf of the capacity of Charleston's harbor, the security it provided, and the harbor's depth. He also added it had access to the best timber for shipbuilding, given that it was closer than any other major yard to the Live Oak plantations. Various advantages would result from establishing a Navy Yard in that city for the building of smaller vessels of war as well as frigates, a process rendered easier with the assistance of steam. To support his argument regarding the depth of the harbor for large, deep-draft ships, Grayson argued that during the Revolutionary War, two British 52-gun ships of the line had passed over its bar safely. It is unknown how Jackson, who had lost his mother due to those ships, received Grayson's appeal. But the Navy would not establish a yard in Charleston until decades later. As part of the focus on Navy Yard facilities, Jackson was intent on continuing the previous administration's policies constructing dry docks. The cost of dry docks, like ships, was largely a function of material and labor. Dry docks were constructed of granite. The first dry dock was built in Norfolk and was considered one of the most important feats of engineering to be undertaken in America during the pre-railroad era. Its construction had begun in 1827 and was completed in 1834 at a cost of $950,000, which was an additional $300,000 of the initial project. A second dry dock was constructed in Boston. Not surprisingly, Jackson took clear, direct interest in the Norfolk dry dock. In December 1830, Jackson, writing in the third person, made his intent known to Branch. "The President desires that you should make known his solicitude to have this dock completed as early as possible, that our large vessels of war may be got in them for repair and prevented from that ruin which must ensure from their present condition." Two of Jackson's phrases in this order shed unexpected light on his policies regarding the Navy. The first was for the rapid completion of the dry dock. The dry dock was unprecedented in the American Republic and was a significant investment, which proves again Jackson's support for the Navy, or at least for the industrial capacity, should a future wartime need arise. The second phrase is that it be completed as early as possible. A more conservative and political approach would have been to extend the work on the dry dock, thus providing jobs for the community for a longer time frame. Instead, Jackson's desire for speed demonstrates a desire for financial efficiency and a desire that older ships would not be broken up or serve as receiving ships. Jackson meant to prepare the fleet fully for war, should the need arise. By 1831, the dry docks were nearly complete. According to Secretary Woodbury, they presented to the eye specimens of stone masonry seldom rivaled in beauty and solidarity. In 1835, Woodbury recommended a third dry dock, this one to be constructed in New York. The Brooklyn dry dock, however, would not reach completion until 1851. Two dry docks seemed enough for the Navy's size. By 1831, Jackson had effectively assessed the immediate and long-term needs of the Navy. Ships that required maintenance and not deemed unfit received an infusion of funds. Partially completed ships at various stages of construction likewise received funding to ensure they did not rot in the shipyards. Just a year after investigating the issue of yard consolidation, the administration reconsidered its initial view. Branch reported to Congress that it should leave open the possibilities of more, not fewer, Navy yards. It is possible that this was done for political expediency. For example, the proposal for a Charleston Navy Yard in 1834 came a year after the nullification crisis. Had it been acted upon, it might have curried favor with the local politicians and citizenry. Moreover, given Jackson's own statements on the future of the Navy, he foresaw a real need for expansion. Most likely, the recommendation was based on both factors. Regardless, his administration argued early in his first term that additional yards would be helpful for repairs if smaller ships were built to increase the size of the Navy. That increase would occur in the middle of his first term. Having the infrastructure in place enabled Jackson to repair, maintain, and construct his Navy. Return of the schooners. As U.S. trade expanded and international threats grew, Jackson authorized the most significant buildup of the Navy since the height of the War of 1812. In 1831, his administration built or acquired 8 ships, more than in any other single year since 1814, when Madison built 9. Jackson also understood the value of smaller ships. They were less expensive to build, less costly to man, and deployed at a higher rate than ships of the line or frigates. Aside from the War of 1812, no class of ship would play a more dominant and needed role than the unrated ships, sloops, and especially schooners. An act of Congress on February 3, 1831, authorized 3 new schooners, Experiment in Washington, Enterprise in New York, and Boxer in Charleston, Massachusetts. This division of labor continued a long-standing expedition from members of Congress. The Navy Act of 1794 had authorized 6 frigates to be designed by Joshua Humphreys. Humphreys rightfully preferred the same shipyard build them. Doing so would ensure that he could supervise the construction of the super frigates that he had designed, and that the shipwrights and construction workers would become more experienced with every warship they built. In addition, it would have resulted in more cost efficiencies, since there would be a direct line from the resources to only one manufacturer, the selected shipyard. Distribution would be cheaper, for example, because it only required one route to the shipyard rather than multiple routes to multiple shipyards, thereby reducing the need for extra personnel. Unfortunately, that was not what occurred in the 1790s. 1830s, or even through the early 21st century. Since the construction of the nation's first 6 frigates, the work was distributed to as many congressional districts as possible, as were the Jefferson gunboats a decade later. This was regardless of the overall cost of the program. When government funds were at stake, it was advantageous to gain the support of as many members of Congress as possible. Such support could only be enabled by distributing funds, and thereby providing jobs among several congressional districts. For Humphreys and his successors in the 1830s, including his son, this meant that ships were built to different standards and that some would simply be better constructed than others. Of the 8 ships authorized, built or acquired in 1831, only one was a frigate and another a sloop. On February 3, Congress authorized ship construction. Sister ships, Boxer and Enterprise, were 10-gun, 194-ton ships with a length of 88 feet. Both designs by Samuel Humphreys were launched by the end of the year and commissioned the following year. Experiment, the only ship of her class, also mounted 10 guns, but was slightly smaller at 176 tons. The William Annesley-designed schooner was launched and commissioned the following year. These ships represented both the reality of deployment rates as well as dangers associated with seafaring. In the case of the latter, between 1798 and 1860, 20 U.S. Navy warships were either wrecked or disappeared. 2 ships were wrecked in 1823 alone, Enterprise and Alligator. On September 11, 1829, the famed War of 1812 sloop, Hornet, was lost with all hands in a gale off Tampico, Mexico. Among her officers was Lieutenant Daniel H. McKay, who had a lengthy correspondence with Lieutenant Samuel DuPont. Their former shipmate, Surgeon John S. Wiley, recounted to DuPont, "Our inestimable friend McKay's bright career is closed forever, as all hopes of the safety of the Hornet have died away. I feel the loss of our friend more sensibly than I expected, or rather my uneasiness has been kept up day by day for several weeks, until by meditating on the subject, my imagination has painted him in all the dreadful agonies of the death struggle, and my flesh creeps at the horrid image." Perhaps there was more loss than friendship that day, or the loss of the ship and its crew. McKay's correspondence on political and naval policy issues reflect an unusual breadth of curiosity. More important was his intention to write articles about naval policy and affairs. Indeed, one letter suggests that he had already written one pamphlet under a pseudonym. For 1829, this was a radical departure from the conservative, tested stance of junior officers to obey their senior leadership without question, and certainly not to articulate them in a publication. McKay's correspondence with DuPont is reflective of the curiosity and commentary given rise by a new generation of U.S. Navy officers. McKay, who received his commission during the War of 1812, could be as critical of his captain and the Navy as he could in expressing his commitment to it, even when he prepared to get underway. "Not, I confess, without some foreboding, not exactly of death and yellow fever, but it's a climate I do not like." A self-proclaimed Jackson man, he suggested that Secretary of the Navy Sammy Southard had the arrogance and presumption to take some officers to task for voting for the general. There were the standard reports among friends of midshipmen returning to the ship so drunk he could not stand and fell overboard, regional conditions and operations, advice on women, commentary of books about steam defense, and politics at home. While in the Caribbean, he reported on acts of piracy and how the officer manning a gun had his legs crushed and amputated during an engagement with one pirate ship. By August, McKay and Hornet had diverted from their intended visit to Havana to the affairs of Mexico. They had received reports about a Spanish force of several thousand soldiers under Brigadier Isidro Barradas, conveyed by Admiral Angel Laborda. Within weeks, General Santa Anna would defeat Barradas, and the Hornet would be lost with all hands off Tampico. It is possible that the Navy's own era of enlightenment might have arrived a few years sooner than it did, as discussed in a later chapter. Or, perhaps, McKay's loss encouraged his fellow officers to reflect on their Navy in a way that might not have happened without his existence and death. It certainly did not escape the attention of his friend, Samuel DuPont, who was to have a significant role in the development of the Navy in the 19th century during 2 wars. DuPont's own recognition and acceptance of McKay's death was sufficient to be entered in his private journal. "I have been somewhat prepared while in Mahon to hear the confirmation of a most melancholy piece of intelligence, the loss of the sloop of War Hornet. By the papers received here, the most sanguine must abandon all hope. I have experienced inward and deep sorrow for one in particular who has gone down with that decorated ship. This may have been more of an impact on DuPont than the rest of the Navy, given other incidents that year. In June, the USS Demologos, the first steam warship, exploded in New York due to an accident. On September 8, DuPont's own sloop, Ontario, was en route to the Mediterranean when the weather that morning had a threatening appearance. The clouds banked up and a fresh wind on the quarter drove the sloop at 9 knots per hour. By mid-afternoon, a gale rapidly approached the ship. According to eyewitnesses, the ship was nearly lost. Had that been the case, in a period of 3 months, the U.S. Navy would have lost 3 of its 38 commissioned warships. All the ships lost were either sloops or schooners. This is not to say that larger ships were not at risk. While rounding Cape Horn in a storm on its return from a 2-year deployment in 1824, the ship of the line, USS Franklin, came within 200 yards of hitting rocks. Only the captain's quick actions saved the 700 lives aboard. Still, it was the sloops and schooners that bore the brunt of the dangers, as Jackson learned again in 1831, with the disappearance of the Sylph, and in 1833, the wreck of the Porpoise. One might argue that smaller ships were more likely to be lost in a storm simply because of their size. Another cause might be the ship's leadership. As unrated ships, they did not have captains in command, but rather lieutenants or master's commandant who had less experience. There is also a third possibility, and that is the level of deployment. Sloops and schooners were the backbone of the fleet, performing duties throughout the world. They were the ships that could most quickly be ready for overseas deployments, including assembling crews. Ships of the line represented diplomatic authority and perceived national strength since few countries could build or maintain them. Frigates likewise performed these roles, particularly the ships like United States, Constellation, and Constitution. Both classes served admirably as flagships but were too few and too manpower intensive to deploy extensively. Although a full study of available ship logs remains to be complete, one way of understanding the usage of various classes is to study the fleet's location at a given time in the year. The best source for that, as previously suggested, are the annual reports of the Secretary of the Navy. Those reports provided the condition and location of the fleet. Based on that available data, a rough idea about deployment rates emerges, although the numbers are somewhat inflated. A rough estimate for the average annual deployment rate for ships of the line from 1825 to 1835 was less than 10%. In the first term of Jackson's presidency, no ship of the line deployed. The average annual deployment rate of frigates during the period was 37%. More telling was that the deployment rate under the second Adams administration was 47.2%. During Jackson's presidency, that rate fell to 28.7%. By contrast, sloops had an average annual deployment rate of 68.2%, schooners 76.6%. Consequently, the greatest need was for the smaller ships. Jackson also understood that the unrated ships served an important role in maritime security along the U.S. coastline. The U.S. shipyards were at capacity in 1831 with the construction of 5 ships. Jackson also had a need to protect the strategic resource of live oak plantations in the Gulf of Mexico. When reports of European smuggling through intermediaries of the trees for their own shipbuilding programs reached Jackson, he took immediate action. He ordered the purchase of 3 schooners in Baltimore, the Spark, Ariel, and Sylph, for immediate deployment to the Gulf. These were lightly armored, reportedly 1-gun, 50-ton ships. It is unlikely that any of these ships had a real impact on protecting the wood from poachers. Within a year, the Sylph had disappeared, and both the Spark and Ariel returned and were sold. Regardless of the losses, Jackson's support of a growing navy in 1831 is yet another piece of evidence that suggests his navalist leanings. To secure his position in that camp, however, required more than just building smaller vessels. Navalists supported the ships of the line. Jackson fulfilled that in his second term with one of the largest ships of the line built by any country, the USS Pennsylvania. To do so, the Navy needed a designer capable of doing so. The designers. Upon first reflection, Jackson's naval policy was strictly in line with the anti-navalists, but it was far more pragmatic than ideological. It simply made no sense to the administration to continue drawing from the strategic reserve of live oak, only to leave them to the elements in the shipyards. Temporarily, stopping new authorizations of ships would allow the administration and the yards to complete construction of the already authorized ships. For this, Branch relied on the British system of using a select few designers and shipbuilders. Ship designers and even naval officers went to England to overtly or covertly study British ship designs, though the American Navy was just as likely not to adopt them. This was the case in the 1830s, when the Americans could have learned from Sir Robert Seppings. Seppings served as England's surveyor in the Navy from 1813 until 1832. Although Joshua Humphreys had radically improved the U.S. frigates prior to the turn of the century, American ship innovation was largely stagnant, unlike the British. Seppings made three major contributions to ship design that the United States failed to discover or adopt. First, he modified the bow from a beakhead bulkhead to rounded bow. The former proved a costly design. Though acceptable during traditional lines of battle, in which fleets fired broadsides in parallel to each other, the Battle of Trafalgar proved that the beakhead bulkheads were too thin and weak to sustain heavy fire. This was especially true of Nelson's flagship, HMS Victory, whose gun crews in the forecastle suffered the greatest casualties as it sailed directly toward the Franco-Spanish line. Seppings' second contribution was similar to the first, as he created the curved stern, bringing the frame timbers to the upper deck. The stern was traditionally the weakest part of the ship, since the quarter galleys for the commanding officer and admiral were tacked onto the hull and supported by a single horizontal crossbeam. Seppings offered the curved stern, which mitigated the stress but also enabled the ship to mount more guns, especially on the stern and port quarter, always the most vulnerable locations on the ship. Despite the improvement, Seppings' design faced significant resistance from the Admiralty and other shipbuilders as they deemed the design unattractive. Seppings wrote to the Royal Academy of Science to defend his position. His third contribution was to support the ship from the interior with diagonal frames instead of the 90-degree riders in the American frigates. Again, speaking to the Royal Academy, he demonstrated the strength of a triangle compared to a square and how that would impact the interior of a ship. The impact of these three innovations suggests that the British models by 1830 were superior to those of the outdated American ships of the line. Despite this, the Reform government relieved Seppings in 1832. It deemed the Navy Board an antiquated and inherently corrupt organization, and it replaced civilians with flag officers. The surveyor was the only position to survive, but King William IV favored William Simons, a former naval officer and yacht designer, interested more in ship speed than durability and firepower. American ship architects and builders were too few to form a formal school like England's School of Naval Architecture that served under Seppings and instead relied on the traditional mentor system. The father of American naval architecture was Joshua Humphreys, whose uniquely designed super frigates enabled the United States to gain single ship action victories against the French and British in the Quasi-War and War of 1812, respectively. The role of chief naval constructor, based in Philadelphia, fell to his son, Samuel Humphreys, who served in that position from 1826 for the next 20 years. Captain William Bainbridge, at that time serving as president of the Board of Naval Commissioners, officially endorsed Humphreys. Bainbridge commended Humphreys as advantageously known to the public, and particularly to the commissioners. The captain considered him one of the most distinguished naval architects in the country, and eminently suitable for the position. Along with Humphreys, the Navy hired John Lenthal the following year to serve as Humphreys' apprentice. By 1828, Lenthal became an assistant naval constructor at the Philadelphia Navy Yard and continued in increasing positions of responsibility through 1871. Jackson's first term also included the services of veteran shipbuilder Henry Eckford. Eckford's construction of ships in the Great Lakes had significantly contributed to halting Britain's advance from Canada during the War of 1812. He may also have had more influence with the administration than even Humphreys himself. In June 1829, Eckford provided the extensive recommendations to Branch on changes to the Department of the Navy. He proposed more control over the Navy by civilians instead of naval officers, such as the Board of Navy Commissioners. Eckford complained that naval officers criticized the labors of the civilians, who are not always competent to decide. A peacetime Navy, he argued, demanded strict economy, but each constructor could improve the quality of ships. The present organization of the Department of the Navy was too defective to serve that purpose. Overall, he made a dozen recommendations, including decreasing the ranks of naval officers and increasing civilian control of the shipyards. Eckford had not initiated these recommendations, but only responded to Branch, who had already surveyed the opinions of senior naval officers. Eckford returned to the private sector. In one project, he built a steam corvette, the Kensington, for the Mexican government, which did not accept it because it was too large. Eckford instead found a buyer in Russia, where the ship was renamed Prince of Warsaw. When Congress funded the construction of the largest wooden warship built in the nation, it again turned to Humphreys. "I was aware of the great responsibility incurred," he later wrote, "and I was also aware that if any accident that happened in launching that ship, whatever professional reputation I might have had, would depart from me forever." It was not just Humphreys' reputation at stake, but the ability of the nation to construct its first line of battleship in nearly a decade. The completion of the Pennsylvania would mean an increase in national prestige when it entered foreign ports. There was also a domestic reality in that it created jobs. Pennsylvania was not a creation of the Jackson administration. The ship had been part of the 1816 authorization bill. What set her apart was she was the only first-rate ship of the line proposed in the U.S. Navy. The design was for 120 gunship as opposed to the third-rate 74 gunships of the line authorized that year. Her keel was laid 6 years later, but then work on it stopped. She would be ignored until Congress took up the 1837 Naval Appropriations Bill just a few weeks before Jackson left office. The bill included a provision to fund Pennsylvania's completion. When the provision was struck from the bill, Philadelphia Congressman Joel Barlow Sutherland rose to defend the funding. The ship, he argued, needed to be built rather than left rotting under a roof. He challenged the chair of the Naval Affairs Committee, Leonard Jarvis, as having expressed preference for small sloops and schooners. One of the reasons for this line of argument was the fear that if a ship of the line were lost, it would take hundreds of American sailors down with it. This ship, arguably, was too big to fail. With a crew complement of approximately 1,000 sailors, the ship would represent approximately 10% of the entire size of the naval force in terms of sailors. Sutherland proposed that the Pennsylvania ought to be fitted out and launched and sent to foreign ports, that it might there be seen what American naval architecture was, what the seamen were, and what force the country could command in war. Congressman Jarvis counter-argued that the ship was so large that only yards in the north could build it, so its construction unfairly favored northern states. Other members of Congress opposed the program because of its cost. Representative John Reed, who had served in Congress for 20 years, alternately as a Federalist, anti-Masonic, anti-Jacksonian, and Whig, proposed the money for Pennsylvania be shifted to domestic programs. Annual maintenance costs for the ship were estimated at $70,000. According to Reed, this was wasteful, given that five ships of the line were at yards. Reed made a valid case. From 1825 to 1835, ships of the line had a deployment rate of 17%, and for 3 years, the Jackson administration had deployed no ship of the line. If Pennsylvania were built, then its fate was likely to be found at American wharves rather than in serving overseas. Reed was ultimately proven correct. The Committee on Naval Affairs denied funding for the Pennsylvania Inn Committee. Rather, it supported funding more sloops and schooners. The $400,000 earmarked for Pennsylvania could instead construct 18 sloops and schooners. This would have accomplished several goals. First, it would immediately expand the Navy's fleet. Second, doing so would increase the number of ships available for deployment. Third, it would have eased the burden on ships that were deployed for long periods, since sloops tended to have the highest rate of deployments. Fourth, sloops usually had a lieutenant or master commandant in command rather than a captain. This was important, since advancement was slow since captains did not retire. Some captains had held the rank since before the War of 1812. More smaller ships meant more early command opportunities for those lieutenants or master's commandant who already had the maturity and experience to lead and to prepare them for greater assignments. Fifth, having additional smaller ships meant more opportunities for midshipmen to learn their profession. Serving as one midshipman among 24 on a ship of the line took longer to learn the intricacies of sailing a man of war. Serving on a sloop meant one midshipman among a few had comparatively more responsibilities and an abbreviated learning curve. A time factor also intensified the Pennsylvania debate. Silt deposits were quickly increasing in the Delaware River. The ship, at a projected 3,200 tons, would be 50% larger than any other American ship of the line, with a draft that would make it impossible to launch in the future. In addition, new street construction in Philadelphia near the shipyard would further complicate and potentially delay construction. When the full House voted, it supported the committee's recommendation by a vote of 125 to 55. Of those voting in support of the ship's construction was John Quincy Adams, who had been elected to the House after his defeat for the presidency. Given the overwhelming rejection of the ship by the House, Pennsylvania should not have been constructed. Instead, the Senate quickly revived it. Records do not reveal the reason for this reversal. The chair of the Senate's Committee on Naval Affairs, William C. Reeves, offered an amendment for $100,000 for launching the ship. After passing in the Senate, it went to the House, where it passed 91-87. Only 2 days remained in Jackson's administration. There is no record of Jackson's official position, but given that he did not veto the bill, he gave it its construction at least his tacit support. Supplemental appropriations were passed to complete the construction. The ship launched in July 1837. An estimated 200,000 Americans attended the ceremony. James Fenimore Cooper, who attended the launch, wrote to his wife, "She is, altogether, the best-looking three-decker I have ever seen." In November, Pennsylvania sailed to Norfolk. In its 24-year life, it never received its full complement of sailors. It never received enough cannons for its design, and it never made it to the open ocean. At the outset of the Civil War, she was burned to avoid capture by the Confederates. There was no real need for Pennsylvania's construction. From an operational standpoint, Reed's evaluation was the most accurate. Enough ships of the line were already available for deployment if needed. Pennsylvania contributed nothing to the deployments of American squadrons, since many squadrons deployed with only a frigate as the command ship. Technologically, this class of ship was already fading from the world's oceans. To make the class relevant, the Royal Navy's last sailing ship of the line, HMS Queen, was launched 2 years later and eventually configured with a steam engine. In fact, all Royal Naval ships of the line after 1839 were designed to include steam power. The last of the Royal Navy's mechanized wooden ships of the line was HMS Victoria, which launched in 1859 and was followed immediately by the ironclad HMS Warrior. The Pennsylvania reflected a divided nation politically and strategically. It divided North from South, the latter suspicious of any federal funds for large projects in northern states. It divided the navalist between those who sought the prestige of large ships and those who saw the benefits of building more smaller ships that were more practical. In Congress, the naval theorists were cast aside in the perennial fight for federal funds for districts. The ship represented a half-year worth of hundreds of jobs in Philadelphia. Jobs meant votes for whatever member of Congress secured those funds. In the end, an expanded Navy was undermined by the need for re-election by members of Congress. This factor may have also played a role in presidential elections. Jackson's second vice president, Martin Van Buren, won Pennsylvania in the 1836 election with only 51% of the vote. Work finished on the ship by mid-1837, just as the economic panic was underway. Had the administration and the members supported the construction of 18 sloops and schooners, as originally proposed, that work would have extended through at least 2 years and several states. Van Buren would lose to William Henry Harrison in 1840. In Pennsylvania, Van Buren lost by the scantest of margins, 50% to 49.9%. thus diminishing Jackson's immediate naval legacy with the transfer of power from his party to another. Nevertheless, it would be the last ship of the line built with the intention of deploying by the country as sail gave way to steam. Steam comes to the Navy. The transition of sail to steam was gradual for several decades. It then grew rapidly, both commercially and militarily, in the 1840s. The most prominent Jackson biography argues that Jackson did not have any sense of what was coming, but it was coming. I don't think he had that kind of vision. He didn't bother to think about it. However, Jackson was not only open to the use of steam technology for the Navy, he actively advanced it. Neither of his two predecessors built a steam warship, and only one purchased a commercial steamship for military operations. Jackson's administration ordered naval officers to gather intelligence on steam warship technology to inform domestic decision-making on naval policy. He pursued the incorporation of steamships into the Navy's force structure and was the first president to use steamships in joint Army-Navy actions. Perhaps this was the most enduring of shipbuilding values in the American Navy as it was in other navies. Historian Bernard Brody writes, "Of the several great naval revolutions of the 19th century, the introduction of the steam warship was, in its tactical, strategic, and ultimate political consequences, by far the most important. No other invention influenced so profoundly the conditions of naval warfare and the factors contributing to naval power. Yet in the two decades that followed its first appearance, the steam warship gained but scant attention. Its introduction was stubbornly resisted by naval officers and largely ignored by statesmen." This is only partially accurate. There is no question about the impact of steam power in the latter half of the 19th century. Americans had had some exposure to steam engines, but there had been little opportunity to fully exploit its widespread applications. Steam power was becoming more common by Jackson's administration, but was still in its infancy as the United States did not yet have significant industrial capacity. Steam ferries, such as one first built by John Stevens in 1802, were inefficient but slowly improving. Despite this, officers saw the future. The prescient but doomed Lieutenant Daniel Mackay, who died with all hands aboard Hornet in 1829, foresaw steamships as the means of war at sea in the coming decades. Reviewing a book on steam defense and vulnerable points of Britain, he relayed to his friend, Lieutenant DuPont, of the absolutely necessity and great facility of protecting our coast by steamers, this now universal mover to the purposes of naval war. The U.S. Navy's inventory at the beginning of 1829 included two steamships. Neither was operational. The Navy in 1822 purchased the Seagull, built in 1818 as a commercial vessel in New England. David Porter, fighting pirates in the West Indies, required shallower draft vessels. The Seagull offered that as well as windless maneuverability in the littorals. In addition, the ship could make round trips back to the United States faster than most sailing vessels. In a 2-year period, she made 3 deployments to serve with the West Indies squadron. In 1825, the ship was considered unfit for further deployments and converted as a receiving ship in Philadelphia until 1840. Seagull was the first operational steam warship, but it was not the first steam warship in the Navy. Seagull was preceded by Robert Fulton's Demologos, the first steam-propelled warship in the world, but it never saw action. Demologos was recognized as a crewed vessel since it was the first. Even proponents suggested it was clumsy, cumbersome, and very slow in her movements. Still, they viewed that the formidable character of the vessel was never actually tested. Fulton had built Demologos in 1815. Although it was not completed in time to fight in the War of 1812, it still drew interest among officers who knew they had barely escaped a broader war loss and disaster at the hands of the British. It was the only steam-powered warship built for the next 20 years, and even its accidental destruction in 1829 did not deter technology's advocates. Articles in the Navy journals recognized that the whole Navy system of this and every other maritime country is about in a few years to be overturned by the superior powers and advantages of steam frigates, steam fortifications, and steam guns. The change, they saw, was inevitable, and the U.S. warship should be built or retrofitted with steam propulsion. One or a few steam warships might be used in the West Indies for piracy suppression, but a few would not be enough in a confrontation with a greater power. With England's 21 steam warships in 1836 and France's 23, a few American steam warships could quickly alter the disparity in naval capabilities between the two powers. This was not a new concept in American international relations theory. During the debate on the ratification of the proposed Constitution to replace the Articles of Confederation, Publius argued in Federalist 11 that there can be no doubt that the continuance of the Union under an efficient government would put it in our power, at a period not very distant, to create a navy which, if it could not vie with those of the great maritime powers, would at least be of respectable weight if thrown into the scale of either of two contending parties. If that held true in the 1830s, as it was proposed in the 1780s, then the United States itself could compete with larger countries by investing in its own steam warships. They could also be used in stabilizing the Gulf of Mexico, given the belligerence of both Texas and Mexico and the potential growth of piracy. That honor fell to Fulton's Demologos, upon which the Navy had been experimenting for more than a decade. She was, in fact, the first steam warship built by any Navy. The shallow-draft, twin-hulled ship constructed during the War of 1812 was intended to support coastal, riverine, and harbor defense rather than blue water operations. Primitively, but understandably, fueled by burning wood, the ship was still an important genesis for the eventual coal-powered steamships of the later 1830s and throughout the 19th century. By the time Jackson became president, Demologos was at the Brooklyn Navy Yard with a full crew, including a captain and a crew of more than 30. Primarily serving as a receiving ship, she was moored head and stern opposite the Navy Yard. According to the commanding officer in 1829, Captain John T. Newton, the ship was in such a decayed state that the decks leaked. The guns were used sparingly out of fear. They would go through the deck. Mounting 16 guns, she had 500 pounds of gunpowder, partly in casks, in the magazine, located along the starboard bow. A standard door stood between the magazine and the light room. On June 4, 1829, in addition to the crew, the ship had prisoners awaiting adjudication, and more than 70 recruits. Newton was escorting Commodore Isaac Chauncey on board for an inspection that lasted until mid-afternoon. Chauncey and the captain left minutes before an explosion destroyed the ship, killing approximately 30 officers and sailors and wounding another 29. Any opponents to the comparatively new steam technology might have used it as an excuse to slow down the pursuit of this radically new type of ship. Branch constituted a court of inquiry to determine the cause. For 3 weeks, the court heard testimony from the surviving crew. The captain testified that his orders, especially regarding the magazine, were particular and verbal to all officers on the ship. The ship always had a sentinel placed at the hatch so as to not to permit any improper intrusion. Every precaution was taken at all times to prevent accidents. Clearly, the captain was wrong in this case, since the event had been the result of an accident. Commodore Chauncey had no knowledge of the cause, but stated that it could not have been the result of the design. It had to be, he stated, accidental. He speculated that either the gunner's mate entered the magazine with his lantern, or he entered the passage to the light room, where the atmospheric state, without ventilation, produced combustion by coming in contact with the lighted candle. According to Marine Second Lieutenant Alexander Mull, acting gunner's mate Thomas Williams had come to the officer of the deck, Lieutenant Breckinridge, to enter the magazine. Breckinridge, later killed in the explosion, ordered him to have the fire and lights put out and a sentinel put over the hatch leading to the passage to the magazine. Mull was in the wardroom when the explosion took place, and it was, therefore, impossible for him to state the cause. If the fault rested with gunner's mate Williams, it did not change the opinion of the witnesses. Chauncey and others noted his lengthy service and unblemished record. Sailing master John Clow testified that a few days before the explosion, the former gunner and he conversed about his successor. Both recommended Williams. Even though Williams appeared to have caused the explosion, the inquiry explored another culprit. Midshipman David McDougall noted that he saw Seaman Hannon go into the hatch at some point, and the sentry did not resist. The court asked if he knew that Hannon was the person under charge of stealing and a bad man. Though there were several questions about Hannon, all that was certain was that his mangled body and broken legs were found after a week in the water. The body was not bruised or lacerated, and the hair was not singed. This suggested that Hannon was not in proximity to the explosion. The court's opinion was that the explosion resulted from an accident and not due to the design of the ship. It concluded that Williams probably had a lighted candle in his hand and that there was no error on the part of Captain Newton or the officers. One should not underestimate the court of public opinion, subject as it is to emotion instead of facts, because the process and result could have been far different. In American naval history, naval accidents have often spiraled into a media feeding frenzy based on assumptions, preconceptions, and political desires. The most glaring example of this was the explosion of the USS Maine that was caused by a design flaw. The media immediately claimed Spain had caused the explosion. The first two American investigations supported this theory. While there was no similar effort to lay blame on a foreign power, any opponents of steam power might have used the incident to delay the development of this new technology. In 1830, engineer John Stevens found that it was time to reassess his views on future naval tactics using steam vessels. He wrote to Jackson that the Board of Navy Commissioners was doing nothing to advance steam technology or to explore how it might be employed in naval operations. The conservative board at the writing of this letter, in March 1830, was comprised of its long-term president, Rogers, Captain Lewis Warrington, and Captain Daniel Patterson. Commodore Charles Stewart would replace Warrington later that year. Stevens held the entire board in little regard. He suggested they all ought to be promoted to admiral, a rank that did not exist until 1862, and moved out of the way so that they would not be an impediment to progress. Stevens challenged their violent and inveterate prejudices. Naval reform was vital, but the commissioners opposed any measures. Steam would be integral to the next naval conflict, Stevens argued. Woe be to that naval power who shall then remain unprepared to meet it. Finally, he shared with Jackson the report of a naval officer sent to France and England to evaluate their naval establishments. This was nothing short of an intelligence mission. Both European countries were making significant progress on their own steam engines and would introduce steam warships into their naval inventories. It is unknown how Jackson reacted to the letter, but it is evident that early in his administration, Jackson was made aware of the steam power issue through one of the few men in the country who had the authority on the matter. Stevens was the inventor and engineer who had built the first domestic steamboat in 1802 and the first steam locomotive capable of towing passenger cars in 1825. In addition, Stevens carried with him the gravitas of one of the most pedigreed families in America. His wife was the sister of Robert Livingston, one of America's founders, and Senator Edward Livingston, who would soon serve as Jackson's Secretary of State and minister to France. Jackson had seen the practical use of steamboats prior to the Battle of New Orleans and his inaugural journey, but Stevens now provided the commercial impetus for exploring this technology for the Navy. Nevertheless, it is possible that Stevens overstepped his bounds among the naval establishment. A few weeks after he sent the scathing letter to Jackson, Stevens wrote to him again, promising to be more guarded in my expressions on the present occasion. If the Board of Navy Commissioners became aware of Stevens' scathing remarks, they could have made him a pariah in naval development. But Stevens was one of the few people in the country who could evaluate proposals for steam engines or bid on future contracts himself. The board also had to be careful of Stevens' family ties. Having a powerful senator in the family tempered their response. Regardless, Stevens recognized the need to be more cautious in his approach on the issue. Stevens' own history presaged the National Industrial Revolution that began to take hold in the 1830s in the United States. Before the American Revolution, the British had prohibited colonial production of weapons, such as muskets. It would take decades for the Americans to develop the ability to tool up and produce quality metals. The extraction of rich ores and other resources meant rising indigenous manufacturing capability. This convergence immediately impacted the Navy. For example, in 1831, the Navy ordered the addition of iron tanks in ships of the line and frigates for both ballast and improved quality of water storage. This represented a departure from the norm, as well as an indication that the Navy and the country were finally able to produce the tanks. The availability of basic resources, increased manufacturing capability, the creative vision by Stevens and others offered the Navy the first real opportunity to pursue a new generation of ships. While cultural resistance from some senior officers continued, the new possibilities had taken a firm hold in the officer corps. Master Commandant Alexander Slidell, Mackenzie, was part of the next generation to acknowledge the application of steam to warfare with specific respect to coastal steam batteries. While such astonishing improvements are making in the application of steam, it would be improvident to overlook its probable importance hereafter in maritime warfare, or fail to keep pace with other naval nations in any new means of attack or defense. Secretary Woodbury would advocate for three such steam batteries in his 1833 report to Congress. Mackenzie noted the experiment of the Demologus. He recommended that Congress appropriate funds to the Department of Navy to replace the Demologus, or at least to purchase new and more appropriate machinery for test. Mackenzie's advocacy was not a meaningless entreaty from one of the many officers in the Navy. He was, instead, part of the Navy's royalty, the Perry Rogers clan that had dominated the Navy for decades. Mackenzie's brother-in-law was Matthew Perry, the younger brother of War of 1812 hero Oliver Hazard Perry. Mackenzie's own extensive authorship in the 1820s and 1830s and his membership in a naval dynasty were more likely to make members of Congress and Jackson listen. It also demonstrated a possible early split in the family, given that the president of the Board of Navy Commissioners was Rogers. The resistance of senior naval officers to steam power was not universal. One of the most senior officers during Jackson's administration was Commodore Barron. He had a checkered career. He was dismissed in 1807 from the Navy for 5 years for having surrendered the USS Chesapeake to the HMS Leopard. Prevented from fighting the British War during the War of 1812, he was persuaded to settle a long-standing conflict with Stephen Decatur by duel in 1820, in which he killed the latter. Barron consequently served in command of several shore stations and shipyards, including the Philadelphia Naval Yard, the center of American Navy shipbuilding. It was here that Barron would propose one of the Navy's most unique and innovative warships. While commander of the Philadelphia Navy Yard, Barron had submitted several Navy-related inventions to the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. Some of his patents included a floating dry dock gun, a gun carriage, and a ship ventilation system. His most significant proposal, however, was for a steam-driven ram ship. In December 1833, Barron reported to Woodbury that his proposed ship could be fundamental to the defense of America's inland waterways and coastline. He had discussed his design with other officers, none of whom dissuaded him from pursuing this concept. Woodbury not only endorsed the proposal, he encouraged Barron to meet with members of Congress to advance the idea. Barron's ship had no guns. Its sole offensive weapon would be its ram prow, much like ancient Greek and Roman galleys. He appealed to fellow Virginian Andrew Stevenson, at that time serving as Speaker of the House of Representatives. At Barron's urging, Stevenson had a model in the House Naval Affairs Committee room for display to help explain the concept to the members. Throughout 1834, Barron secured the support of more officers who saw the value in such a warship. The proposed ship would be capable of 8 knots of speed, more than enough to pierce any enemy's hull. At the beginning of the next congressional session in 1835, the House Naval Affairs Committee supported construction of such a ship. The committee noted the ship's simplicity and capability that went well beyond just being an experimental project. Already it envisioned a fleet of cost-effective, small, crew-sized ram ships protecting America's coastline. With a proposed length of 250 feet, the ship was also unusual in that it would have 3 hulls. Between the hulls were steam-powered paddle wheels to protect them from enemy fire. The Board of Naval Commissioners scrutinized the steamship. It had Samuel Humphreys and John Linthal visit businesses that built steam vessels and engines in order to assess the Barron model. When the naval designer and constructor reported, the board concurred that the vessel ought to be mainly constructed for harbor defense, travel at 10 miles per hour, and carry 2 heavy pivot guns able to throw 8- or 10-inch shells and 4 32-pounder carronades. Humphreys and Linthal also recommended the ship to be about 50 feet shorter than proposed by Barron. Despite the endorsement of the committee, the House failed to authorize funding. The lack of debate on the issue fails to shed light on the reason behind this, but there are 4 possibilities. First, Congress was concurrently considering the expensive ship of the line, Pennsylvania. The House may have simply chosen to support one over the other, and since the Pennsylvania would result in more immediate jobs, that tended to be the politically expedient choice. Second, Barron's advocate in the House, Speaker Stevenson, had left office in the middle of his term in 1834, having been nominated by Jackson to serve as minister to England. Before Stevenson resigned, however, he was accused of having set into motion several of Jackson's policies, thus leading to accusations of quid pro quo. This was ironic, given Jackson's denunciation of the so-called corrupt bargain of the 1824 election. Jackson's opponents denied Stevenson his appointment. Therefore, it is possible the steam ram ship was simply wrapped up in this controversy. Third, it is also possible that Barron himself confronted a populist and hostile House that still remembered the death of America's greatest naval hero by Barron's hand, something he suspected when he approached Jackson himself. Whatever the reason, the Naval Affairs Committee and Barron were prescient. The development of these ships in the 1830s would have had an important role 25 years later at the outbreak of the Civil War. Ramming of enemy ships came back into style, and the riverine systems were filled with makeshift steam ramships. Barron's novel design, benefiting from another generational development, might have shortened the war. Regardless, the House did not abandon steam warships. A fourth and more likely possibility is that they chose to invest in a different steamship under consideration at the same time as the ramship. Fulton II. If Jackson seemed undecided about Barron's ramship, he appeared to have endorsed another steam warship, which became known as the Fulton II. The proponents of this ship had several advantages over the competing Barron design. The Board of Naval Commissioners invested more time inquiring about it, suggesting an openness that was not evident with the Barron design. It benefited from an intelligence-gathering mission by a member of the Rogers family, while Rogers served as the board's president. Finally, civilians experienced with steam engines were under consideration for contracts in a way that was absent in Barron's proposal. In November 1833, the Navy sent Master Commandant Alexander Slidell Mackenzie to Britain. Mackenzie published a two-volume book in 1835 about his time in Britain, as if he were a common traveler observing architecture, people and events, much like Alexis de Tocqueville did with democracy in America. Absent from the book, however, was much mention of the Royal Navy for good reason. Mackenzie had sent a full report on the Royal Navy steam warship program directly to the Board of Naval Commissioners. Rogers had ordered Mackenzie to go to England with a clear mission: to procure as accurate information as possible relative to the construction of steam vessels of war in the British Navy. When he reached England in early 1834, he visited the principal dockyards, where he observed the latest steamships and made acquaintances with Royal Navy officers. Whether this was spying or intelligence gathering, it was not unprecedented by other countries. One historian notes, two French Navy officers were sent to the United States in 1820 to report upon the properties of the steam vessels there, and this event was followed by the purchase and addition to the Navy list of a few unarmed steamships. But in the spring of 1830, six armed steamers were available as auxiliary warships and dispatch vessels in the expedition against Algeria. Mackenzie reported that the British Navy had two types of steamships. The first was a smaller vessel for use as mail packets and as ship tenders. These range from 100 to 300 tons. The second class included offensive warships at 600 to 900 tons and 147 feet long. Mackenzie assessed that their bows were sharp and could make 10 to 12 knots. He also gave specific assessments on individual British ships. A broader value to the Mackenzie report was its intelligence on opinions of Royal Navy leadership and the inherent inability to get accurate information. Captain Sir William Simmons had been appointed surveyor of the Navy 3 years before Mackenzie's arrival. Simmons had proposed new modes of naval construction that enabled construction of larger ships, which met with opposition from traditional shipwrights and the school of naval architecture that had closed in 1832. Simmons' larger design quickly became obsolete as steam power emerged. Nevertheless, the two camps within the Royal Navy, the old and new schools, as Mackenzie called them, were not reliable sources for the capabilities of the new steamships. Each side presented its own facts that best supported their case. For example, the new school tended to inflate ship speed and performance to gain the support of Parliament. The same was true of the sailing navy, who wanted to justify their own shipbuilding vision. Mackenzie's report was not solely focused on steam warships. Given the number of ships of sail that comprised the majority of the Royal Navy, Mackenzie also reported on newer ships, such as the 50-gun HMS Vernon. Perhaps his most important observation regarding the traditional sailing navy was how the Royal Navy was cutting down some of their smaller ships of the line into frigates, such as HMS Barham. There was a direct correlation between British policies and American shipbuilding. It is no coincidence that the U.S. Navy pursued the same with the ship of the line USS Independence, which was raised and became a 54-gun frigate in 1836. In 1835, the Secretary of the Navy requested $150,000 for the completion of the Fulton II. This was more evidence that Barron had little senior support for his design. Nevertheless, the Board of Naval Commissioners continued to be cautious about any option citing a lack of construction experience and untested cost estimates. The hull itself was already under construction when, with no decision made on the steam plant, the board advertised in major newspapers in the hope of contracting out for the more complex technology. The board was still unsure it could find any appropriate individual or firm, noting, "From the board's ignorance upon the subject of steam engines, they are in doubt whether the advertisement gives the necessary information to enable persons to make proper offers, and they are satisfied that they are incompetent themselves, and have no person under their direction which could furnish them with the necessary information to form a contract for steam engines. Should the lowest offers happen to be made by persons whose general character and responsibility would not offer great security for their completing the engines in the best manner." By January 27, 1836, the board had received only two offers. Governor Kemble of the West Point Foundry proposed constructing the engine and boilers, while Daniel Large proposed manufacturing only the boilers. The design of Fulton II was changing and adapting to the latest improvements in technology. With the board paying generous attention to the subject, the members recognized that they lacked the expertise in the construction and management of steamships. Between the contractors, the board selected Kemble's West Point Foundry on February 17. Kemble had a long history with the Navy, having served as a Navy agent in Spain during the Second Barbary War, where he learned about casting iron. He was also involved in Democratic politics in New York. After gaining the contract in 1836, he was elected to Congress. One of Kemble's employees was Charles Haynes Haswell, a 28-year-old marine engineer who had first worked on Robert Fulton's commercial steamship, Clermont. Haswell was also connected with the Navy's reformers as one of the few civilians to hold a membership in the Naval Lyceum. Still, the board reserved full support for Haswell. Several firms and individuals sent letters of recommendation that concurred on his intelligence and familiarity with construction of engines. Nevertheless, the board remained concerned that he had no practical experience on ships. Despite this, Haswell was appointed first chief engineer of the Navy 2 days later. By August, Rogers reported to Acting Navy Secretary John Boyle that work on the Fulton II had been long delayed and that several more months were required to build the engines. Delays in ship construction, particularly of a new class, have been common in U.S. naval history. It took another year, but the Fulton was finally launched in 1837, after Jackson left office. Even had there been a national security crisis or a sense of national urgency, it is unlikely that the ship could have been constructed more quickly. The industrial capacity of the country and the Navy were not yet mature, and with this ship, the Navy could not get it wrong. Captain Isaac Chauncey having assumed the presidency of the board after Rogers fell gravely ill, reported to Secretary Dickerson that the Fulton would probably be ready to accompany the ship of the line, Pennsylvania, if deemed necessary. Had that happened, it would have been an impressive sight, the new escorting the old. That might have been America's moment, like what British artist J.M.W. Turner had captured with The Fighting Temeraire. Support for new steam warships was not universal. Some older, conservative officers and later Secretary of the Navy, James Kirk Paulding, had reservations. However, they failed to collectively articulate their concerns in the pages of the journals, whether by intent or necessity. One opponent did note, "As for steam, it will not do at sea. Contending with ships of the line, this mode of warfare does not comport with the dignity of our nation. We have abundance of material for shipbuilding, skillful hands to construct, talents to direct, and bold hearts to use them." Jackson would not have fallen into the category of the conservatives. While the Fulton was under construction, the president had drawn the military into the Second Seminole War. 6 months after the war started, Jackson personally ordered the deployment of 3 steamboats for riverine operations in Florida. Jackson's presidential term was more navalist than anti-navalist, given the number of ships he authorized to be constructed. But Jackson was not only interested in raw ship numbers. His administration reflected a mature understanding of national needs for the fleet and types of ships that best supported the various missions required. He displayed a remarkable balance of investing in the highly deployed sloops and schooners, the prestige offered by one of the world's largest ships of the line, and the advancement associated with supporting new steam technology. In addition, he authorized the construction of the first armed supply ship, a radical departure from the first 6 presidents. While it was only one ship, it was a clear message that the U.S. Navy would be expected to sail to any distant station and support itself if necessary. He understood the importance of investing in shipyard infrastructure, an important, albeit overlooked, aspect of advancing a nation's navy. Because of Jackson's administration, the Navy could build upon fleet diversity and infrastructure support to conduct more global operations.